We're a little early, but I hope you don't mind if we just go ahead and get started since everybody's here and ready. I want to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals. And before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Dana Womack. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach, and I'm Bonnie Setter, the Chief Justice of the Court. It's my understanding that everybody's here and they've checked in and they're ready. But before we begin the arguments, I'll ask the clerk to call the case, please. You may begin.
Peace Court. I'm Mike Ware. I'm from Fort Worth, Texas. I represent the appellant in this case, Danita Tuck. When you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. That's paraphrasing the Cheshire Cat, and that's basically what the state is arguing. Case. What we've got here is an indictment charging the appellant with conduct that under the Texas Penal Code is not criminal conduct, is not defined as criminal conduct. She is charged with a crime that does not exist. When that is the case, under the Rodriguez case, and this is count four of the indictment, under the Rodriguez case, once you've looked at the indictment charges a crime or charges conduct that is not criminal in nature. And the court, in this case, instructed the jury to find the appellant guilty if they found that the state had proven this conduct that is not criminal in nature. Then there's no need to look any further. The Rodriguez case doesn't talk about Jackson versus Virginia or legal insufficiency of the evidence in that context. It doesn't talk about the Malik case. It doesn't talk about analyzing the hypothetically correct jury charge. It just says that when someone is charged with conduct that is not defined, or is basically doesn't exist, is not defined as criminal conduct in the Texas Penal Code or anywhere else, the evidence is legally insufficient. Now that's how we got here. I raised that exact point in my grounds for review with the Court of Criminal Appeals. They granted my PDR and remanded to this court for an analysis based on that argument. And yes, I've repeated that argument here. I've repeated the argument that the Court of Criminal Appeals granted my PDR on for this court to consider.
But didn't the Court of Criminal Appeals limit our review to the addressing the sufficiency of the evidence to prove attempted murder?
That's exactly right.
And so they didn't tell us to look at the charge, the indictment. They didn't tell us to look at any of that. They told us to look at the sufficiency of the evidence to support the conviction.
Under the Rodriguez case. That's correct. And I'm not saying you have to look at the indictment or the court's charge. The state is saying that. And under traditional analysis of sufficiency of the evidence, that's what's done, but that's not what was done in the Rodriguez case. I argued this case should be reversed on insufficiency of the evidence under the Rodriguez case. And the Rodriguez case says just what I just said. When someone is charged with and is tried for, as in this case, this is the whole state's theory of the case, for a crime, for conduct that is not criminal in nature, then the evidence is always going to be legally insufficient. There is no amount of evidence that can be presented by the state such that someone can be guilty of conduct that is not criminal in nature.
Then why was it remanded to us? If it's that simple, why didn't the Court of Criminal Appeals just simply reverse?
Well,
it seems to me they wanted us to do something more than just to say, well, it's just insufficient as a matter of law.
Well, I wasn't privy to all the discussions at the Court of Criminal Appeals. I'm just saying those are the arguments I made. Mm-hmm. Evidently, to some degree, they agreed with them because they remanded it on those grounds.
Sure.
Perhaps they want to give this court the first chance at ruling the evidence insufficient, and then they can decide whether or not they want to elaborate on the Rodriguez case in this case from there. I don't know. I can't read their minds. But they did.
Counsel, is there a difference between the Rodriguez case, which was a murder case, and this being an attempted murder case? Is there a distinction there?
Well, there's always some distinction between cases. That's not a distinction that is important in this case. It was actually a felony murder case, and the felony, which is an unintentional murder, and by definition, the felony murder statute, just as the attempt statute, requires an act. Specifically, requires an act. The penal code defines conduct as an act or an omission. Then it defines act. It defines an omission. These are not just words that are used willy-nilly in the penal code. And under the clear language of the penal code, any attempt requires an act, just as felony murder requires an act. And an omission is not an act. And an allegation that this crime was committed by an omission is not an allegation that this is even a crime, just as it was in Rodriguez in the felony murder case.
So are you taking both positions that it's legally insufficient because of the indictment, the problem with the indictment, and that there's just no evidence of anything other than omission? Are you taking both positions?
Well,
because I see them as different.
Yes. In a way, yes. I'm saying this case never should have gone to the jury.
I get that part, but the question is, if you're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, are you saying that there's no evidence out there at all of anything other than omissions?
I'm saying if you're going to look at it that way, which is not the way the Rodriguez case looked at it, if you're going to look at it a more traditional way, mm-hmm. under Jackson versus Virginia, mm-hmm. which was never cited or even referenced in Rodriguez, under Malik, which was never cited or even referenced in Rodriguez, and you say, well, what we first have to do under a traditional analysis, we have to look at the hypothetically correct jury instruction and measure the evidence against that. Now, what would the hypothetically correct jury instruction look like in this case? Now, there's one more thing. The hypothetically correct jury instruction has to be one authorized by the indictment. And so the jury instruction in this case, which the state never objected to, the state never said, well, we need to add these things to the jury instruction, or we need to take this out of the jury instruction. The state never objected to the jury instructions. We did. We moved for a directed verdict and all of that. The state sat on their hands and said nothing and allowed the judge to rule that, in fact, an omission is an act. But under this jury instruction, no amount of evidence would make the appellant guilty because the jury instruction instructed the jury on conduct that is not criminal in nature.
Right, that's the first argument. And then my question is, but in the alternative, would you argue that there's no evidence of anything other than omissions if the Jackson standard was applied?
Well, once again, I'm trying to envision what the hypothetically correct jury instruction would look like, because that's what the Malik case and the other cases say. And I don't think there can be a hypothetically correct jury instruction.
So it really is a legal point. It's not a weighing of the evidence.
Right. But I don't think under the circumstances, and it goes back to my quote from the Cheshire Cat, I don't think you can have an indictment, a jury instruction, a trial, and a whole theory of the case based on one thing, and then go back and say, well, that's conduct that's not even criminal that she was convicted of, and then go back and search the record and say, well, is there anything in here that would support a criminal conviction on anything? And I don't think that's a proper analysis. Now, I think to answer your question, even if you go to that analysis, I don't believe there's anything in the record that would support sufficient evidence on an attempted murder. An attempted murder, I mean, how would that indictment even look? Attempted murder by removing CT from Ronald McDonald House, which she voluntarily put him into to begin with. Attempted murder by inquiring of a hospice provider about the appropriateness of fentanyl and then never following up on it. And if that was so awful, then why didn't Connie Kohler, the hospice provider, jump all over her about it? You know, she said, I just ignored it. Attempted murder by what? If you get down to that, you know, to the point where you're talking about. I don't think there is any act in the record that would, in and of itself, have sustained a sufficiency of the evidence for attempted murder. I guess you got to stick to the indictment to some extent, by neglecting to provide food and nutrition. And of course, the indictment and the jury instruction made very clear that the gravamen of this offense was an omission by saying at a time when she had the legal obligation to act or to do that. Just hammering home how this allegation is strictly of an omission. And to that extent, I think the Rodriguez case is right on point, even though it involves a felony murder. An act is not an omission. The law is very clear. The attempt statute very clearly requires an act. No act was alleged. No act was given to the jury as an option to convict on. And so, no, I don't think you can go back and look at the record and say, well, is there any act anywhere in there that would sustain a verdict of guilty on attempted murder? I don't think you can do that. But if you do, there's nothing in there that in and of itself would sustain a legal sufficiency analysis of attempted murder. I mean, if that's the law, someone would be better off without an indictment. You know what? You're better off, you know, just saying, well, you know, go to trial. Everything's fair game. Just defend yourself against everything. I mean, you're better off doing that. At least it's honest, rather than saying, here's the indictment. Here's what you're defending against. Here's the state's theory. And then on review going, well, the evidence is legally insufficient on that, but is there anything in the record that would sustain or would survive a legal sufficiency scrutiny on appeal? And that's antithetical to the rule of law. That whole argument, that whole position is antithetical to the rule of law. And it's not the law. So the state names, I guess, several things that supposedly, even though not alleged in the indictment, not argued, not the theory under which the state tried the case, would arguably sustain a legal sufficiency of the evidence analysis. And none of them do. As I mentioned, I can't imagine saying that under these circumstances, removing CT from the Ronald McDonald House was an attempted murder. I mean, the evidence was undisputed why she did that. The evidence was undisputed that was done because the people at the Ronald McDonald House would not return her phone calls, would not communicate with her, and they became worried. The evidence is undisputed that her husband was with her when they picked him up, that the family was there the next day when CPS came, that the child was fine, that the child had just finished eating a big bowl of watermelon. And to couch that in terms of an attempted murder is, even if it were appropriate, would not sustain a legal sufficiency of the evidence scrutiny. Same with everything else that they've alleged. You know, inquiring about fentanyl when another hospice provider had actually advised her to inquire about fentanyl. And inquiring about fentanyl has nothing to do with failure to provide nutrition and food. So it doesn't add up. It's Now, it's a clear case that count four is legal insufficiency of the evidence for every which way, for every reason. Oh, and by the way, my brief specifically requests that the case be reversed on legal insufficiency of the evidence and that ultimately a judgment of acquittal be entered on count four. I'm not exactly sure what the state meant when it said my prayer for relief was inappropriate for legal insufficiency of the evidence. I think they refer to page 18 of my brief.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ann Grady. I represent the state in this matter. It seems to me that the argument you've just heard could have just as easily have been the oral argument held upon the initial appellant's brief in this case, the one filed by Abe Factor. That is not what was remanded. In fact, the PDR took issue in grounds 2 and 3 with the indictment having alleged a non-existent crime and this court erring by finding that claim unpreserved. The Court of Criminal Appeals refused those 2 points. Whether this court is now bound, precluded from addressing them, I'm not sure, but the Court of Criminal Appeals emphatically did not remand for reconsideration of what this court has already determined, which was to reject the claim against the indictment. This court's prior opinion actually correctly found that count 4 of the indictment tracked the attempted murder statute and that the language specifying failure to provide nutrition was the manner and means of that offense. Rodriguez.
Tell us what acts actually would support not sufficient evidence.
Well, Your Honor, this is a course of conduct kind of case. Obviously, sending a child to bed without supper is not attempted murder, contrary to what some of them might think. By definition, by necessity, if you're alleging attempted murder by failing to provide nutrition, it's an ongoing activity. Ongoing activity is the phrase used by the district court when hearing the motion to when hearing argument on the motion to quash and rejecting it. When counsel was alleging this was vague, that they need more particularity, the trial court did not even need the state to respond. He said, well, it's an ongoing activity, right, Mr. Smith? And Mr. Smith said yes. So that's one thing that's necessary to understand is this is a course of conduct. None of the individual acts was deadly, but all of them were part of a scheme, if you will.
Tell us what the specific acts were.
First was enrolling in hospice care at all. Dr. Huffman never told appellant that CT was dying. He recommended hospice specifically to provide at-home nursing care. Catherine Sowers, the RN coordinator at Cook's, met with appellant and her parents, and they discussed the purpose for this was to prevent all these recurring trips to the ER. Remember that Dr. Hansen, who was CT's primary, had not seen him since July 2015. He was just being brought to the emergency room, and whoever was on call in the gastroenterology unit was treating him. Dr. Huffman was the one treating him February 2016. And was the one to say, okay, this family needs help. I think there was already actually an infection. This family needs help. So that was the stated purpose from all the providers at Cook's. Nevertheless, when Sowers gave appellant 3 potential hospice providers. Angela and Aware was one of them, Vita's was another, and I forget the third. She spoke apparently to both of them. And it's interesting, she spoke to Connie Keeler and presented it as, CT is terminal, he's dying, I need hospice care. So she's the one who first said that, and that was said to the hospice providers. Ironically, that's corroborated by Tiffany Hunsaker, who was called as a defense witness. She was the VITAS coordinator. And in February 2016, she's receiving from appellant the information that this child is dying. So that's important to understand all of the subsequent acts, is that she's enrolling in hospice care and commencing this deception that he is dying, and that affected all of the ensuing decisions by hospice care providers. He's dying, our job is to make him comfortable. So that's why they're going along with depriving him of food and supporting mom's decision that food should be withheld and preventing outside family members from bringing food in. That's why they're putting him on escalating levels of opioid painkillers in addition to the methadone, morphine, and then it's while he's still in the home that she mom wants him on Dilaudid, and she tells Connie Keeler, don't talk to my family about this. They're not supporting this. And it's this ongoing course of conduct of attempted murder. So that I'm emphasizing enrolling him in hospice care in the first place for that reason. You then have stopping the TPN feeds. Again, under this context of we don't have a doctor making this decision. Mom is basically the primary medical care provider here deciding to stop the TPNs and getting the providers, the nurses, Cindy Raines and Connie Keeler, to say okay and to go along with this because, after all, he's dying. Moving him to Ronald McDonald House, it's not a medical care facility. This was a place where mom had greater control over his over outside family members potentially giving him food. And yes, she's the one who put the sign on the door to say no outside food. She had asked Connie Keeler for such a sign the day before, and hey, it materialized. And Connie Keeler or Kohler repeatedly said, no, I'm not the one who put the sign on the door. And we have a text from mom to Cindy Raines saying, we put the sign on the door. Mom is one of we, whoever the other person is. It wasn't Connie Kohler. Those are all actions as part of a constellation of actions taken in order to affirmatively deprive him of food and nutrition during this course of conduct. If fentanyl is not relevant to failing to provide, it is relevant to her specific intent, that in the context of all of this, where she's the one who said terminal, she's the one who said he's dying, and she's the one who told that to Tiffany Hunsaker. So yes, when she's withdrawing him from Ronald McDonald House and withdrawing him from Angel Unaware's care in order to get him enrolled at Vitas, it's because she has convinced Tiffany Hunsaker he's terminal. That's why Tiffany Hunsaker is okay with fentanyl, not to provide care for a child, but to provide comfort for a dying child. Those are all of the, I don't know if they're all the actions, but those are some of the actions that the record supports showing beyond mere preparation actions tending to affect the resulting crime of murder, which is the test. Rodriguez, I want to discuss Rodriguez just briefly. How's my time? My time's fine. Rodriguez is not a watershed case. We have had definitions for omissions and actions in the penal code for quite some time. It was a routine application of the legal sufficiency standard. Rodriguez, the facts of Rodriguez is, it's a locked room mystery. Baby is born October 3rd. Baby is dead by December 8th. That's less than 2 months. Mom is the only adult caregiver in that home, and the child died of starvation. That's all the state had. And the state called an expert to explain there's only one way this happened. And so the state's indictment and the state's proof at trial was withholding food, withholding nutrition, withholding hydration. The state, the indictment also said failure to ensure adequate nutrition. So it was an omission case from indictment to proof at trial. The Court of Appeals in Austin said, well, but the jury may have found associated acts with that, such as feeding the child too little, and they affirmed. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said, no, you need to have some, the legal sufficiency standard does not require extensive, but it does require any, quote, any record evidence from which a rational jury could have found the requisite elements of the offense. And in Rodriguez, it was simply lacking. And yes, the Court of Criminal Appeals engaged in that analysis. It was a legal sufficiency case. It was not an indictment case. They looked at the evidence adduced at trial and found no proof of any act, and for that reason reversed. This court should engage in identical analysis here. Look at the evidence at trial and see whether there is any record proof of actions associated with her intent to kill. And upon finding ample proof, must affirm. This court is not the 13th juror deciding whether it believes that this happened. I think that there are crimes that are inherently difficult to believe. There are crimes that are easy to believe. Robbery, usually at trial the issue is identity. But there are crimes that are difficult to believe, and surely that a mother would attempt the murder of her own child is one of them. And this jury spent 5 days grappling with that question, and they found proof beyond a reasonable doubt enough for all 12 of them to unanimously agree and find her guilty of attempted murder. So now this court is in the position of to accepting every inference in the verdict's favor, looking for any record support for the jury's verdict. And if there is any from which a rational jury could have found as this jury did, it must affirm. I want to also make sure it's clear, it's almost like an expression, a colloquialism, that she was charged with attempted murder by omission. Count 4 does not say the word omission, in contrast to count 3, which alleges an omission. Count 4 alleges acts. And of course, the jury was charged on that as well. I think that's the only last clarification I wanted to be sure to make. I also want to go, I'll close with just inviting the court to perhaps do a better job than the McGuire court did in clarifying this. This court did address a similar issue in Mallard v. State. That was one in which the allegation was it was a felony murder conviction that the perpetrator had struck a pedestrian, as he nods, and failed to provide medical care, but failed to do it by driving the victim home and putting her car away with the victim concealed. That was an act associated with this failure. And so I think to clarify the difference between a failure to act, which is an omission, and other types of failures, which can in fact be actions, if you're driving and you fail to yield, it's because you drove into traffic. To clarify some of the law here, that's what this case gives the court an opportunity to do. With that, unless there are further questions, I'll rest on my brief.
So this is not an attack on the indictment. That ship is sailed. This is exactly, as I argued to the Court of Criminal Appeals, a legal insufficiency point, and as they remanded to this court on, citing Rodriguez, as I did, in my argument to them on legal insufficiency. So it's not an attack on the indictment, but any analysis of legal sufficiency of the evidence can't ignore the indictment. And in this case, the indictment alleged in words almost exactly like the words in the Rodriguez case, that part of the of those two indictments are almost identical, and that court found without a doubt that those words allege an omission, not an act. Now, the whole issue of CT.
Counsel, in the indictment, by alleging an attempt as opposed to an actual felony murder, doesn't that imply, or doesn't that tell the accused that there's going to be an offer proof that there were acts as part of the attempt?
No.
Why
no.
Not?
It doesn't. Because it alleges an omission.
It alleges an attempt of an omission.
An attempt by omission. That's certainly nothing the state ever argued. They didn't argue it when I argued the motion for directed verdict. They didn't argue that when I talked about the jury instructions. What the indictment alleges and what the jury and the instructions of the jury required, what the jury did is they did not find her guilty of attempted murder. They found her guilty of conduct that is not criminal conduct. Now, there was a lot of dispute about the process by which CT was put into hospice care. Dr. Huffman did, for the first time on the stand, say, well, that was just for insurance purposes. You know, it was kind of an insurance scam, and I was a part of it, and everybody knew about it. It was just so that insurance would pay for it, but he wasn't really terminal. Well, there's no documentation about that conversation. There's no documentation that was his point of view. That came up for the first time in trial. There are two certifications from two physicians as are necessary and are in evidence that CT was terminal with less than 6 months to live. Two physicians signed off on that. That was necessary before someone can be put in hospice care. Now, I ask you, if this was all just sort of a wink, wink, nod, nod insurance scam, as the state's saying Dr. Huffman said it was, then why, when CT started improving and getting better, as he undisputably did as time went on, as he got over the sepsis, as time went on, why did everybody get so freaked out and say, well, maybe he's not hospice appropriate after all? You know, maybe we can't recertify. If it's all just a scam, wink, wink, as the state says Dr. Huffman said it was, why did that whole thing happen? And finally, as far as cutting off the TPNs, that was probably a good thing, a wise decision. The central line and the TPNs have a huge downside. And the doctors knew this was going on. It's not like she did this in secret. It was probably a medically sound best decision under the circumstances.
But we're not allowed to presume best case scenario for her. We're supposed to indulge in favor of the state's prosecution on review of the sufficiency of the evidence.
I understand that, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, you're saying, well, this was a good thing to do, and we can't look at it that way. We have to look at whether there's evidence that it was a bad thing to do, because if there is, we have to indulge in that in that favor.
But at the same time, in light of the whole record, you can't take that completely out of context, as the state has done, and presented it as this diabolical effort to murder this child. Cut off the TPNs. You have to put it in the context of the undisputed state of the record. And the undisputed state of the record is it was probably a good thing. It was probably a sound decision at the time. It definitely was a sound decision as we know it now. Instead of taking it as this sinister evil act trying to murder her child. The doctors knew about it. That's part of the context. That's undisputed. It was probably the central line in the CPN through which CT caught sepsis and almost really did die. That also went into the thought processes of removing the central line. I mean, there was a time during this period that it's undisputed that CT almost did die from sepsis. It was probably from this central line. So to couch that as an attempted murder is just not accurate and not fair. The state.
You're out of time, so you need to wrap it up.
Yes. The state indicted this case for conduct that is not criminal, for a crime that doesn't exist. They allowed the jury to be instructed accordingly on conduct that is not criminal for a crime that doesn't exist. They tried their case around that theory. And now they're asking this court to bail them out. And these arguments came up for the first time on appeal when I raised sufficiency of the evidence. This was never argued at trial. This was never the state's theory at trial. It's not this court's job to bail the state out. Thank you.
Thank you. Counselors, we appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful to us. The case has now been submitted, and you're free to go about your business. Thank you.
Thank you. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in recess.